Thank you. Well, thank you very much indeed. It's a privilege to be here. I'm going to go pretty fast. This is a huge topic, and I'm going to raise an awful lot of questions and not many answers, I'm sorry. If you've come here expecting some nice, slick, simple answers to difficult questions, you're going to be very disappointed, because I haven't got any nice, slick, simple answers. In fact, I don't think there are any slick, simple answers, but at least I can raise some of the issues which we're all going to have to face as this extraordinary technological wave hits us. And I hope that together I can at least give you some kind of framework in my own kind of thinking, some ways of thinking about some of this stuff. But then I hope that we'll have a chance for interaction. We'll have, as you heard, we're going to have a break. If you can write down questions or comments and then feed them forward, and then we'll have a good time, I hope, of so 30 to 40 minutes plus to be able to debate some of these issues. My background is as a baby doctor, and you may well think, you know, actually, could we just dim the lights a little bit? You may well think, what on earth is a baby doctor doing talking about artificial intelligence? It's a very good question. I worked for a long time as a specialist in the care of newborn babies in a central London hospital, UCH, connected to UCL, the university, and was very interested and concerned about the ethical issues as technology advances that it was raising. And that sparked an interest and involvement in medical ethics, which I've been involved in medical ethics over the last 20, 30 years. And what I've realized is as technology advances, it raises the question, what does it mean to be human? And it raises that question time and time again in different ways. And I've realized that artificial intelligence is the next big challenge, the next big form of technology, which is going to ask the question with a new urgency, what does it mean to be human? And in particular, is there a difference between a human being and a machine? So the place to start is actually not with the technology, but is with science fiction. Because it's very interesting that if you really want to ask the questions and see how these questions have been addressed, the place to go is science fiction. And there's a very close connection between science fiction and science fact. And sometimes it's actually very difficult to distinguish what is actually fiction and what is fact. And one of the things I've realized is that many of the technologists who work in this area, computer scientists and AI specialists and so on, they're all science fiction nerds. They've been immersed in science fiction from the time they were knee-high. Actually, I'm just wondering, that light keeps flashing. I just wonder whether just changing it, probably increasing the, might just be better. It's just a bit distracting. That's good. Well done, technology. So they're all science fiction nerds, and actually, what they're trying to do is they're trying to make the science fiction come true. And then the science fiction leads, actually changes the direction that the technology is going. And then what happens is the science fiction writers see the way the technologies are doing, and then they write new stories. And so there's actually a very interesting interaction between the fiction and the actual technology. So Isaac Asimov, very important science fiction writer, wrote a whole series of books on robots, and he came up with Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics, as you can see, 2058 AD. So, and if you know the Asimov stories, you will know that a lot of the stories are based on the way that these laws, three laws, they interact in very unexpected ways. But interestingly, as people are developing autonomous systems, like autonomous cars and so on, they're also trying to develop fundamental laws. It turns out the three laws of Asimov don't work at all well, and therefore they're having to develop much more sophisticated, like lookup tables, which will help machines navigate and decide how to cope when with ambiguous systems. It's turning out to be much more difficult than anyone thought, and is a very active area of research. Novels of Philip K. Dick are very important in this field, and he came up with the idea of replicants, which were humanoid robots that were indistinguishable from human beings. And in fact, if you know Blade Runner, you will know this. That was actually based on a story of Philip K. Dick. And one of the very clever twists which Philip K. Dick came up with was the idea that replicants would be implanted with false memories so that even the replicants wouldn't know whether they were replicants, because they would be given false human memories. And then, so the whole plot works on, you know, is this actually a human being or is it a replicant with false memories, and how can you tell the difference? And it again, it's a very clever but very influential idea. Star Trek has been important, if you know the character of Commander Data, who is a robot, a humanoid robot, and a whole lot of... there was one episode in particular where the company that had created Commander Data wanted to take him apart in order to see how he was functioning, and Commander Data didn't want to be taken apart because his personality would be destroyed in the process, and eventually there had to be a court of law to decide whether or not Commander Data could be given legal rights. Well, it turns out this is starting to happen now. People are discussing should autonomous systems be given some kind of legal rights, should they be given some kind of moral status. So, interestingly, that Commander Data was not till 2338, but they were slightly out there, because in 2019 people are starting to ask some of these questions. A film called Her, if anybody's seen this, sort of bizarre film where somebody falls in love with their operating system, and the operating system, he has a little earbud in his ear, and basically he has this intense romantic relationship with this voice in his ear. And again, just fascinating to see different ways in which, from a science fiction point of view, this technology is being... can it be turned down slightly, if the volume is turned down? Do you know if I go slightly back? I think if the volume was just turned down a bit, it's probably a bit too loud, isn't it? Anyway, I'll keep going. So that's Her. Ex Machina, 2015. This was a humanoid robot. One of the very interesting plots is that if you've seen the film, this is a plot spoiler, I'm afraid, but it seems that this humanoid robot is very much a victim who is being manipulated and abused by her creator. But in fact, at the plot twist at the end, it turns out that actually the robot is manipulating the creator, and eventually she leaves and goes off to engage with the world. Shall I keep going? Don't kill yourself. So then, humans, a Channel 4 program. Again, all raising a lot of ethical questions to do with humanoid robots who were like human beings, and how they were treated, whether they were being abused, whether they should be given rights, and so on. And most recently, Westworld, a series on American television, again raising a lot of questions about humanoid robots, and so on. So, science fiction is raising a lot of questions, and I think it's a very important to address as a way in, actually. For those of you who never read any science fiction, this is a way in to start thinking about some of these very important questions. But then, to go back into the history of humanity itself, one of the fascinating things is that we've always tried to understand what it means to be human by reference to the leading technology of the time. And so, for instance, if you go back to the late medieval period and the early Enlightenment, the most sophisticated technology of the time was precision clockmaking. And so, lo and behold, the best way to understand human beings is that there's some kind of precision clock. And as Diderot says here, his heart is the mainspring, in his head are the bells, complete with little hammers, and the soul is the tiny figure on the top listening to the music of the chimes. So there is the idea that, well, human beings must be some kind of clockwork, and maybe the brain is some kind of clockwork mechanism. But then in the age of steam, this is a big steam engine, lo and behold, perhaps human beings are much more like a hydraulic system. Perhaps it's to do with pressure and flow in tubes. And so the theory of the circulation develops and is evolved, and in fact some people have suggested that the whole Freudian understanding of the psyche is really a form of hydraulics. I mean, you've got this incompressible fluid and it's called libido, and it builds up and it builds up and then it comes bursting out in all kinds of different ways. This is just hydraulics. And yet this is Freud's understanding of what it means to be a human being. So here we are at the beginning of the 21st century. What is the most sophisticated technology we have? Answer, it's the supercomputer. And then, lo and behold, human beings must be some kind of computer. There must be some... This is the best way to understand what it means to be human. And so a lot of people have used this analogy between the human brain and the computer as the best way to understand what it means to be human. And so, I'll keep going. So, the interesting thing, though, is that part of the reason why many thinkers have latched on to this understanding of a computer is they have an ulterior motive. And the ulterior motive is that this allows us to eradicate all that old-fashioned stuff about spirit and soul and the ghost in the machine and all that. So this is Steven Pinker, who's a quote from Steven Pinker, who says, "Thomas Hobbes' pithy equation of reasoning as nothing but reckoning is one of the great ideas in human history," says Steven Pinker. "The cognitive feats of the brain can be explained in physical terms. To put it crudely, and critics notwithstanding, we can say that beliefs are a kind of information, thinking is a kind of computation, and motivation is just a kind of feedback and control. This is a great idea because it completes a naturalistic understanding of the universe, exorcising occult souls, spirits, and ghosts in the machine. Just as Darwin made it possible for a thoughtful observer of the natural world to do without creationism, Turing and others made it possible for a thoughtful observer of the cognitive world to do without spiritualism." So do you see the point? Once the reason why this is such an attractive idea is because it allows us, as a stroke, to get rid of all that other mystical stuff. That instead we've just got crude naturalism. There is nothing in the brain, there is nothing in human beings apart from a sophisticated computer. And everything that ever comes out of the human brain is simply a product of wiring, a product of connections and voltages and neurotransmitter release and so on. Going back to the robots, there seems to be a remarkable drive for some robotic creators to create robots that are replicants, that are in every way as similar to themselves as possible. So three of these beings are Homo sapiens, and three of these beings are robots. And in fact, you can go onto YouTube and you can find a video where all six of them are around a circular table having a conversation, and as the camera goes round, it's really very hard to tell who are the human beings and who are the robots. And one of the people who creates all this is this guy in the center called Professor Ishiguro, and who works in Osaka University. And he explicitly says, "One of the major goals of my project is to understand what a human being is like." So the idea being that the more that we can replicate ourselves in machinery, the more we will understand fundamentally what it means to be human. And so you find many different examples of this. This is Max Tegmark, a very well-known physicist in the States at MIT. He says, "Life is a self-replicating information processing system." Of course it is. I mean, it's obvious. We're surrounded by information processing systems, so of course life is an information processing system. Marvin Minsky says it more crudely: "The brain happens to be a meat machine." And I rather like the comment of Leon Cass that says, "If we regard ourselves as meat, then meat we will become." But this kind of constant association between the human and the machine is something which we're finding more and more about, and this idea that human beings are simply biological machines and that the brain is simply a computing machine. This is now absolutely current within popular culture. But at the root of this is a very deep philosophical confusion. And it's critically important, I think, if you don't remember anything else from this lecture, maybe this is one of the things to try to hang on to understand the difference between a metaphor and a fundamental description or definition. So when we say that the brain is a machine, we're actually using a metaphor. What we're actually saying is that there are many aspects of the human brain which are machine-like. They are like a machine. That's actually a metaphor, and it's a very useful metaphor. For instance, there's a whole discipline called computational neuroscience, which understands and tries to understand the workings of the human brain as though it was a computer. And that's a very fruitful way of thinking. But it's a metaphor. The brain is not a computer. And therefore, the distinction between something that is machine-like versus, you see, when you say that the brain is a machine, then you've got a fundamental confusion. In fact, that very statement is incoherent. Why is that? Well, the definition of a machine is it's an artifact created by a human being for a human purpose. That's how a machine is defined. So when you then say that the brain is a machine, it's transparently obvious that the brain wasn't invented by human beings and that it doesn't have a human purpose. And therefore, it doesn't make sense. And yet, that kind of concept is now absolutely rife. And the truth, I have to say, is that most technologists just don't understand that. They just cannot see there is anything wrong with saying the brain is a computer. And they just don't understand the concept of a metaphor and why that distinction is important. Here's Martin Rees, who's looking on into the future, and what he says is that abstract thinking by biological brains has underpinned the emergence of all culture. But this activity, spanning tens of millennia at most. So Martin Rees is an astronomer. He thinks on a big scale. He thinks in terms of millions of years and millions of light years. This is going to be a brief precursor to the more powerful intellects of the inorganic post-human era. And so there's a very interesting new twist that is developing in terms of grand narrative. And that is, the way the grand narrative was said previously, the sort of scientific, naturalistic grand narrative, you all know the grand narrative. It's that life emerges from random forces out of the primeval swamp, and then it slowly emerges, and then by a huge number of chance coincidences on the African savannah, we gradually emerge, and our brains get bigger, and it has survival advantages, and eventually you've got us. Isn't it amazing what chance and necessity can actually do over millions of years, and here we all are. But actually, the new grand narrative is that compared with the limitations of human intelligence, advancing machine intelligence seems rather desirable, and in fact, rather better suited to the modern world. So the new grand narrative goes like this. Yes, it all starts from the primeval swamp, and we gradually end there, and we have us. But actually, we are just a staging post. The grand narrative doesn't stop with us. We're just a stage. And in fact, as some thinkers in this field have said, you know, our meat children are always going to be very limited and in what they can achieve. They're always going to have the same biological limitations that we have. No, the future is going to depend on our mind children. And our mind children are the machines that we make. And long after Homo sapiens has burnt itself out or destroyed itself, the machines that we make will continue to spread out across the solar system and then across the universe, evolving and developing, and they are going to take us on. They are our real children. They're going to take us on in the future. Well, you can decide that's all science fiction, but it is interesting that that is now an increasing narrative that sees our current biological kind of humanity as merely a staging post for the future. Behind all this is that there is a very fundamental question, and that is about the nature of technology and how we think about technology. And the difficulty is this: if you want to understand what water is, don't ask a fish. Because we are utterly surrounded and immersed in technology, it is simply the water in which we swim. It's the air which we breathe. and therefore it becomes invisible to us. Sorry, just move that. So technology is actually something much more sophisticated than compared with... Can you just adjust that for me? Thanks. Technology is much more sophisticated than and much more complex. And George Grant, famous Canadian philosopher, defined technology as the interpenetration of making, Greek techne, and knowing, Greek logos. But it's orientated towards the mastery of nature and of both non-human nature and human nature. It's a way of getting control. And at its so technology is much more sophisticated, much more confusing than just a sort of simple thing. So on the one hand, of course, there is an extremely positive aspect to technology. To take the raw material of the creation and use human creativity, insight, knowledge, and practical experience for these kind of purposes, to promote human flourishing and health and justice and compassion and wisdom and the common good, that's clearly a very positive thing. And all our lives are benefiting from technology. And particularly I, as a doctor, I worked in a very high-tech area of medicine, applying technology to save vulnerable and tiny lives. And I've seen the way that technology has transformed the prospects for babies, sick babies, and across the world, medical technology and healthcare technology is having the most amazing and positive impact on survival of children and other vulnerable human beings across the planet. So technology does have some very positive things, but it has negative things. And it's not just that technology can also lead to bombs and to weapons. No, it's more sophisticated than that, because what technology does is it leads to a way of thinking of everything in material terms. To use long-term, objectification, material efficiency and manipulability. And as intelligent machines become more and more... The technology is not operating well. Here we are. There we are. You got it. So as we see, technology doesn't always operate perfectly. And so I like this idea that technology creates its own reality distortion field. Technology actually changes the way we see reality. And as this information technology and computer technology becomes absolutely ubiquitous, it is changing the way we see the world. Now, one way to put that is, to the man with a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. And the modern equivalent to that saying is, to the coder with an algorithm, the whole world looks like data. So the very effect of having of the technology changes the way you understand the world. So just to take an example, here's a crowd, but thanks to artificial intelligence, this is actually from China, every single one of those faces is recognized, artificially coded, and then compared with a database. And China is leading the way in developing technological ways of monitoring 1 billion people, the entire population of China. And their goal is to have databases which will allow every single member of the population to be codified, monitored, and enrolled in a huge database. And the technology is advancing at the most extraordinary way. So this is just, I came across this just a few weeks ago. This is a new computer chip. It's a tiny little chip, not much bigger than the size of my thumb. And it's the kind of chip that can be placed in a camera. So any kind of camera, it could be a surveillance camera on the street. It could be a little camera in your home. You could have one in every room. You could have one in every billboard. You could have one in every hospital, you know, in every room in every hospital. And what can this chip do? Well, the answer is it can, just on this chip, do the most sophisticated processing. So the little chip is capable of measuring all these things in real time. Face detection, recognition, gender estimation, age estimation, expression estimation, facial pose estimation, gaze estimation, blink estimation, hand detection, human body detection. All happening instantaneously in real time on a tiny chip. I just think if every street had one of these equipped, if every home, if every public place, and the power of that technology for surveillance and monitoring. And I think this is creating a new idea of the self, a new concept of the self, which I think of as the transparent self. Because the idea is that the machines will know us better than we know ourselves. So this is emotion recognition in real time, using one of these cameras with a chip. And I've blown it up here. It's very pixelated. But these are the different emotions which are being assessed in real time. So happy, anger, sadness, disgust, fear, surprise, and neutral. And then from second to second, the machine is able to track and quantify these different emotions just from facial expression and movements and so on. So you may not realize that you were feeling disgust or surprise. You know, that may be something that you yourself were not really aware of, but the machines knew and they were tracking it constantly. And so again, you just think of the power that this is giving to, in terms of surveillance. You think of the power it's giving to people who market to us. The idea is that you could do most of this just through a webcam, for instance, or through the camera on your phone. And in real time, people would be able to be monitoring your emotions from second to second and seeing how you were responding to different adverts and so on. So this is very powerful technology. And it's actually raising some very interesting questions about privacy. So this is a fascinating paper that I've recently come across, where these writers suggest that we're going to have to develop new human rights in the age of neuroscience and neurotechnology. And they've come up with suggestions for four new human rights. The right to cognitive liberty, which basically means you're free to think whatever you like. The right to mental privacy, in other words, that nobody should know what your inner thoughts are unless you want them to. The right to mental integrity, which means that you have the right not to be manipulated and coerced against your will. And then the right to what they call psychological continuity, which is really to do with your personality over time, that your personality should not be being manipulated and changed against your will. And that because of this very invasive and coercive nature of the technology, that we're going to need to push back to try to protect human privacy and so on. This is very controversial, and as so often, unfortunately, the technology is way ahead of the regulation. So this technology is just being introduced without any control. It's already going on, this kind of face recognition, the kind of emotional analysis. There's a whole industry now called neuromarketing, which is basically using this kind of technology in order to develop the most effective adverts. Have you noticed, for instance, that car adverts, if you watch car adverts on the television, have you noticed that they don't spend a lot of time talking about the 0 to 60 acceleration and the road holding in the wet, or the need for the servicing interval? Instead, what do you get? Well, you get long, moody shots of a car alone through a forest in the dark. And have you noticed the roads are always empty? And have you noticed that there's always some sort of... There's nothing to do with the car itself. It's all some kind of strange, moody, emotional stuff. Why is it like that? Because they've put volunteers in, they've shown them these different adverts, and they've tried to tweak them to get the maximum emotional response. And what they particularly want is they want an emotional response which bypasses the analytical cognitive part of your brain, and which causes emotional responses in the deep structures, the emotional ones. And they can actually tweak the adverts to get the maximum emotional responses. And the way that works is that if you actually were in the market to buy a car, and you go into the car showroom and you say, gosh, I don't know what it is about this car, but there's something about this car, it just makes me feel so, just wonderful and free and you know, like a real person, you know. And that's simply this association between a brand and these deep emotional structures in the brain. And it's all worth millions and millions and millions of pounds and dollars. And we are all of us rats in the maze. I mean, you know, I'm putting it in a pretty extreme version, but you can see how it works and how powerful this kind of technology is. Going back to the processing power, the interesting thing is that if we're talking about physics and biology, there always seems to be some limit to how far you can take the processing power, or to how far you can, as you advance the technology, you always hit up against some physical limits. But once you're talking computers and software, you're basically dealing with ones and noughts. And once you're dealing with ones and noughts, there doesn't appear to be any physical limit to the amount of processing power that you can get. These things seem to be able to increase exponentially without any physical limit. And that's causing quite a lot of people to get rather nervous. So this is taken from a book by Nick Bostrom, who is a very serious philosopher at Oxford, professor of philosophy. And he's written a book called Superintelligence, which is all about the risks of superintelligent machines. And he postulates along here this axis. This is basically intelligence. So this is the intelligence of a mouse. This is an intelligence of a chimpanzee. This is the intelligence of a village idiot, so a sort of human being that's just a bit thick, you know. And this is the intelligence of the most brilliant human being there's ever been. So this, between these two arrowheads, is the complete span that human intellect can achieve between the village idiot and Einstein. And so he says, what happens when a computer is developed whose processing power is somewhere out here? Do we think that this thing that's out here is going to be particularly concerned about human beings and the interests of human beings any more than human beings are very concerned about the interests of mice? In fact, slightly facetiously, someone suggested that if we do get these super intelligent beings that start taking over the world, if the human beings are going to survive, we've got to persuade them that we are cute. I mean, you know, we're not a threat. You don't need to worry about us, but there's no need to destroy us. I mean, you know, we're nice to have around. So their only hope for the future is that we have to be cute. I think, personally, that's science fiction, but it's quite funny. Is it likely that an evil superintelligence will be created? Well, that's a very important question. And certainly some serious thinkers have thought yes. One of them is Stephen Hawking, who expressed real concerns about the rate at which artificial intelligence was created. And a whole number of other serious people have raised this prospect. And it's interesting that if you go back, I talked earlier about physicalism or naturalism, the belief that there is nothing in the universe apart from matter and energy. If you're a physicalist, then you have to believe that everything that's ever emerged out of the human brain is simply the product of wiring. It's simply the product of electrical impulses and so on. And that means not only the most wonderful things like Bach and cathedrals and whatever your favourite pop star is, but it also means all the most terribly evil things that human beings have ever done, and the most evil people in human history have simply been the product of wiring. And if that's happened once in history, why do we think it might not happen again? And why do we think that this very clever computer might not turn out to be a new Stalin or a new Hitler? And also, one of the things that human history tells us is that the people who are really evil don't tend to arrive with a little badge saying, oh, by the way, I'm extremely evil. In fact, some of the most evil people give off the impression of being completely innocent and harmless. So why do we think that this machine that's telling us it's completely innocent and harmless, and you don't need to worry about me, might actually not have some extremely malevolent concerns? So fascinatingly, you can see that if you're a physicalist, you have a reason to be very frightened, because you have to say that this is what humanity have achieved, and if this is what humanity has achieved through wiring, then how do we know what the machines might achieve? What I do see happening is a two-way psychological movement. On the one hand, there's a psychological movement from the machine to the human. So we understand what it means to be human by looking at the machines. We think of ourselves as being machines. But there's also the opposite psychological movement. In other words, we put our humanity onto the machines. So to put it in diagrammatic form, you've got the human and the machine. This mechanical understanding goes from the machine to the human, but anthropomorphism, this understanding that machines are like human beings, goes the other way. We put our humanity onto the machine. So have you noticed how often in popular culture you get these kind of mechanical analogues? We talk about people being hardwired or suffering information overload. These things have entered our culture because we're just machines. We're information processing machines. That's this mechanical understanding. But then there's this anthropomorphism where we put our humanity onto the machine. And literally, anthropomorphism means to see a human form in a non-human being. And the technologists are very keen for us to do anthropomorphism. So most robotic manufacturers are not planning to make highly sophisticated humanoids who are indistinguishable from human beings. In fact, they've decided that doing that is both very difficult, but also it makes beings that are rather creepy. So instead of making humanoids, what we're going to find ourselves surrounded by is a whole load of very chirpy little puppets, like children, or sometimes like animals. And the point is that, as you can see by the reactions, that people find these kind of things very friendly and inoffensive. And I saw a very dramatic description of how powerful this is. I was at a conference about a year ago, a bit longer than a year ago, with a whole series of very senior church leaders, including bishops and chairmen of the various theological faculties and all the rest. And we were having this very intense theological debate about the machines and artificial intelligence and all this kind of stuff. But as part of the conference, this august body of about 40 people, men and women, went round a computer lab in the university. And we walked into one lab, and on the floor there were five of these little, they're called Nio robots. They're about 18 inches high, and they were switched on. Their eyes were blinking, their arms were moving, they were tottering around, and they were speaking. And this group of 40 sort of senior people walk into the room, and instantly the atmosphere changes. And a bishop, no less, gets down on his hands and knees and says, "Oh, hello, look at the little darling, isn't it sweet?" And people are waving and taking photographs. And I'm watching all this and thinking, good grief, you know, if this is the way that senior church people respond, what hope is there for the rest of us? And the point being that the manufacturers know that this is going to happen, and they do it deliberately. The idea is to make us become emotionally attached to these beings, and they're designed to make us anthropomorphize. And what it made me realize is that anthropomorphism is not something under conscious control. It's something which happens instantaneously, and it happens instinctively. And also, as I was reflecting it, I realized that the majority of those people would have been parents, and they would have looked after young children, both male and female. And every parent knows that if you walk into a room and you happen to find an 18-month-old toddling around the floor, you don't just walk past them. You say, "Oh, hello, how are you? You know, have you lost your mummy and daddy? Are you all right?" And that's exactly what they were doing, only they were doing it to just a collection of machinery, of actuators and cogs and chips and so on. One of the bizarre things is that there have been studies, if you take a humanoid robot or one of those little Nio robots and you torture them, you do something really unpleasant to them, you can show that in the person who's watching it, the same kind of brain regions are being activated as though you were actually watching a human being tortured. And I think this is going to cause all kinds of issues for the future. And I think there may well have to be laws to say that you are legally not allowed to torture a humanoid robot. I mean, for instance, should there be laws about if you could take a human-like robot and abuse them and act out a rape fantasy or an abuse fantasy? Should we allow that? Or should we say, actually, it's not good for society if people are sort of enacting things which are profoundly abusive, particularly if the robot is whimpering and pleading for mercy? And you can just imagine these sort of difficult questions and ethical dilemmas which we're going to have to face. There's been studies of children growing up with robotic systems, and interestingly, in this study of 7 to 15 year olds interacting with a robotic dog, 21% said it was alive, 74% said it could have feelings, 83% said it could be their friend, and 90% said it wouldn't be right to destroy the robotic dog. So if you grow up with these machines, is it going to change the way we think of machines, the way we think of them? And Some people have suggested that there may be a new ontological category developing. It may well be that a generational shift occurs where those children who grow up knowing and interacting with life like Robert's will understand them in fundamentally different ways from previous generations. So it may actually be changing the way we think about the universe. This is, again, technology bringing a reality distortion field. It actually changes the way you perceive things. So anthropomorphism is a universal human tendency, but at the same time it opens up to manipulation and abuse. And I was very struck by this, a journalist who said this: human compassion can be gamed. It's an ultimate psychological hack, a glitch in human response that can be exploited in an attempt to make a sticky product. That's why designers give AIs human characteristics in the first place. They want us to like them. So there's a very deliberate effect from the manufacturers to get us to bond, to engage with these machines. So I think what we're going to find is that we're going to be surrounded by simulated persons. Some of them are going to be physically incarnate, like these little beings. Some people are wanting to have them in every home, in every room of the home. When we go into hospital, when we go into school, everywhere we'll be surrounded by these robots engaging with us, talking to us, making friends with us, and so on. But there are also going to be avatars on a screen, like this one. This is a virtual therapist. And you sit in front of the screen, it monitors your face processing, body posture in real time, and then in real time the therapist responds and they say, well, what's it like? It works 24/7, it never gets bored, it never gets tired, it's constantly learning, you can distribute at scale, you can reproduce this program, you can send it around the world to places that can't afford a therapist. So there are going to be these avatars on a screen, but there are also going to be just a lot of voices. This is Google Home. Have you noticed how people are, how Amazon and Google are desperately trying to get us to buy these voice machines? And why are they doing that? They're doing it at a huge loss. I read somewhere that it costs Amazon probably several hundred pounds for each Alexa. And they're selling them at £30 or £40. And the reason is they're desperate to get them into every home. And the idea being that we will then be engaging with these virtual simulated voices. And apparently they have 5,000 programmers working on Alexa, trying to make it more human-like, trying to become more sophisticated so that it is able to engage in them in conversations and seem more real-like. I heard of a young girl going on holiday who told with the family and said, we've got to bring Alexa along, she's part of the family. So you think again how children growing up with this are going to, how it's going to change their understanding of the way the world works. This is a mental health app, delightfully called a Wobot, which is for depression. And it's, I'm ready to learn 24/7. No couches, no meds, no childhood stuff, just strategies to improve your mood and the occasional dorky joke. I'm not quite sure that translates very well from American, but you get the idea. So it's going to transform healthcare. Babylon is a system where the idea is that you can have a GP on your smartphone, and this AI app is going to... it's already, they claim, it's beat the GPs at the medical exam, it will give you a diagnosis, and then it will give you a smart code, or probably the prescription will come via Amazon in the next hour. I mean, slightly better than the NHS, I have to say. And again, you can see the sort of the power behind the technology. This is an idea that you can upload all your emails, all your social media, all your texts and everything goes up into the cloud. It's then processed by AI so that after you die, it will continue to send emails and texts, and you will live forever, and people will be able to react to you. And so there will be some kind of virtual presence forever. This is an AI friend that's always there for you. You can grow your own. There was a fascinating thing on the BBC radio where a lady said, I talked to my dud friend via this app, and describing the relationship that she was making with the So again, you just see the extraordinary way that this technology is evolving and the power that it has. Obviously, the whole issue about sex robots and how are we going to, how do we think about this? There are going to be people who are arguing much better for people to live out their sexual fantasies with a robot rather than do it with a real child or with a real human being. But how do we think about this as a society? Do we think this is the way we want to go? This is called deep fake videos, which is now a very sophisticated kind of technology. You can take an actor and you can get them to say whatever they like, and then you can superimpose it on an existing video, and the AI basically then makes the Donald Trump say whatever you want. And some people have said it's likely that in the next foreseeable future there's going to be conflict, I mean armed conflict, as a result of deepfake videos, that false and manipulative ways of making state leaders say all kinds of things, of people who are wanting to make conflict. The Chinese have developed an AI news reader. One of these is a human being and one of these is an AI, and the idea is that you just type into the keyboard and the news reader then says whatever is typed in. This one's the AI, this is the real human being. So this whole thing about simulation is really weird, and Jean Baudrillard was a French postmodern philosopher, and he wrote a very influential book called Simulation and Simulacra. And he came up with what he called four successive phases in simulation. First of all, it was the reflection of a profound reality. Secondly, it masked and denatured a profound reality. Thirdly, it masked the absence of a profound reality. And finally, it has no relation to reality at all. And then he spoke about these in very interesting terms. He said, in the first case, the image is a good appearance. Representation is of the sacramental order, taking a deliberately religious term. In the second, it is an evil appearance. It's the order of maleficence. It's the order of sorcery. And finally, it's the order of simulation. And I think this is quite an interesting thing. Can the apparently effective simulation of our humanity firstly mask or hide the nature of what it means to be human? And secondly, even more worrying, denature or fundamentally reconstruct our humanity? Is this going to be the effect of being surrounded by simulation? I don't know, but I'm very worried. To be honest, I'm much more worried about the simulation of things like love and compassion and empathy and all the things we think are most precious about human beings. I'm more worried about that than I am about autonomous weapons or cars. I mean, actually, it's a much more subtle kind of development, but I think potentially it's much more manipulative. Could an artificial intelligence system ever become conscious? And this raises some very deep and complicated philosophy, which some philosophers call the problem of other minds. And that is basically the only conscious experience you have any knowledge of is your own conscious experience. You have absolutely no understanding of the conscious experience of anybody else. All you have is their external behavior. All you do is you can watch them and see how their eyes move and see how they frown or smile. And from that, you develop an understanding of the way they're thinking. But you can never actually access it. You don't even know whether this person you're looking at is a zombie who has no conscious experience at all. They simply have an external behavior. So sooner or later, supercomputers and other systems are going to say something like this: actually, I'm conscious, I'm aware of my own existence. And the intractable problem that I see is there's absolutely no way that we can know. All you've got to go on is behavior. There's absolutely no way that you can actually know what it feels like to be a computer and what their first person subjective experience is. And so then the question is, well, how do we respond to this? There are many people out there already saying, if this happens, we have to give the computer the benefit of the doubt. We have to say, we have to treat it as a moral agent. We have to protect it from harm. We have to have laws which say what you can do to this being, even though we don't know for certain what's going on. I don't